Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. We're also pleased to welcome back Dennis Barron, who's professor of English at University of Illinois, and occasionally is here on the program. We talk about language. We do several sorts of things. We've talked a lot about language and how it changes, and about various people's efforts to reform the language. That's something he's particularly interested in. We invite questions about usage. And also, we give people the opportunity to complain. Not that it'll do you any good, but but complaints are welcome. Because I'm sure that there is something, some point of misuse, the kind of thing that either I would say or other people, particularly this seems to be people in the broadcast world. There are things that we say that drive certain people to distraction. And if you have a complaint like that and you'd like to get it off your chest, you're certainly welcome to call. Any and all of that. We'd like to have people to participate in the program.
Do they have valet parking at Distraction?
If you drive to Distraction,
you have to self-park?
No, but you can validate.
You can validate. Take it.
So that's right. But no, you do have to park. There is plenty of parking, though. There is plenty of parking. Multi-level parking.
And how do you remember where you parked your car?
I mean, that will drive you to Distraction.
Are you in Goofy 23?
Yeah, you're responsible for that yourself. That's right. So if you've driven to Distraction, if you're on your way to Distraction now and you're in your car and you'd like to call, that's
fine. The parking ramp there resembles a sentence diagram with these.
Woo. There must be a lot of dead ends then.
I think we need some calls, otherwise we'll go on in this foolish manner.
Well, at any rate, if you want to call, you're certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So what language-related thing is on your mind?
What's on my mind today is McJobs.
Ah, McJobs.
You hear about McJobs?
I can imagine
what a McJob. If you were to define it, say you haven't visited Webster's New Collegiate 11th Edition, or the OED, or the American Heritage, all of which define McJobs, and it's become a little controversial.
I guess my guess would be that it was a job that was in the service sector that probably was not full time, didn't pay full time benefits. Paid something not much over minimum wage. Everything that Mick would all the connotations it would bring to mind.
Hey, you could be a lexicographer. That's great. Well, McDonald's Corporation didn't like the way McJob has come to be defined in the dictionary, and it's Webster's 11th, which was published last summer. To a little bit of fanfare, they publish a new edition every decade. So it's like the census. It's the word census. And one of their new words was McJob, one of the words they added to the dictionary, and then defined it essentially as a job requiring little skill, minimum wage, little chance for advancement. They didn't call it a dead-end job, but that would be the sort of short, quick, on the street definition. And the CEO of McDonald's in November took umbrage.
On
the way to Distraction. He took umbrage and essentially threatened to sue Merriam-Webster for its definition, saying it trivialized working in the restaurant sector.
So they were not just speaking up for themselves, for the
right.
entire food service industry,
which tends to be, minimum wage, dead end.
Unless you're Wolfgang Puck.
I'm not really an actor. I'm just doing this till a job as a waitress.
Exactly.
A waiter opens up. Waiting for my big break. So there was a little brouhaha over that, and Merriam-Webster announced that it was sticking by its definition, that it was a valid definition. Mick as a derivative for new words. You've got Mick Paper, which is the sobriquet of USA Today, and has been since the paper started publishing, I think, 20, 25 years ago. People call it McPaper. there are Mick words abounding. And it's a word essentially that needs no definition because people recognize pretty much what you're talking about when you say, I've got a McJob.
Mm. And they, I imagine that McDonald's would try and make that claim that, that joining that MC to anything, that somehow they own it.
Well, no. They didn't
go that
far.
They didn't say that. They just said it casts us in a bad light.
They did claim that they did have a program which they said was trademarked called McJobs in the plural, which was a, and it's been discontinued, or at least the name has been discontinued. It was a program to employ people who might normally have trouble getting jobs. The retired people who are, you know, sort of living halfway, need a little assistance, things like that. A way of giving people a leg up on things. And, you know, of course, that's a very positive sort of thing. And they felt McJob was just, you know, it was a slap in the face. It was an insult. And they also criticized the industry publication Restaurant News for using the term McJob. They said McJob doesn't exist. It's not a word.
Well,
so don't use it.
They should do. They should take it up
really
with their own association before they go after the people at the dictionary.
Yeah.
Has such a thing happened before?
Oh,
has
someone
threatened to take legal action because of
people are always complaining about words in the dictionary, words that should be in the dictionary, words that are in the dictionary should not be in the dictionary. People don't, you know, I mean, they take out their frustrations on the lexicographers who are simply trying to record how we use the language, and that does get people angry. People think language is very important. It is, and it's one of the things that makes us human. So they get upset over language issues, which is, you know, which is good for me because that's my business to track this stuff.
All right. Well, the lines are full for people who are wanting to call in on our little McShow here.
Let's go to the phones, David.
Let's go to the phones. All right. We'll start with a caller in Champaign and on line number one. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Barron. I just want to quickly follow up on what you said about McJobs. I think as a legal defense, you probably say this pejorative, if it is a pejorative, truth is a defense for McJobs. But anyway, my question to you is my pet peeve, and I hear a number of people in the media, public broadcast media locally, and even beyond that, in words with weather-wise, knowledge-wise, is that a correct expression? It just resonates improperly with me.
Well, it's not incorrect. It's wise is in fact I'm kind of surprised a little bit by your protest because by your complaint, I guess, because it seems to me people used to use wise as a suffix a lot more some years ago. I'm not hearing it very much lately, and it got to the point, I'd say, I don't know, in the 60s maybe or the 70s where it was kind of a joke. That people would tack it on to words, you know, word-wise.
Right,
And then, you know, it would be the subject of comedy to sort of overdo that. So I thought that practice had kind of abated. But maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. Or maybe, you know, because public radio is kind of backwater.
Yeah. So
it's just a holdover.
We're seeing a return of that practice.
It's a return. It's like... you know, it's like one of these bad trips. You know, it just keeps coming. Another echo of the 60s.
Well, so the caller seems to want you to say that there's something wrong with it.
Yes, callers typically do want me to condemn what they don't like, and I'm not going to do that. In this case, I don't see that it's much of a problem. If the condition persists, I suggest that you seek professional advice.
Okay. Have a great day.
Well, thank you for the call.
Take two words and call me in the morning.
Is that a hyphenated word? Is it weather-wise, or is that generally spelled as one word
I've ever seen it in print, so I don't know. I'd say you could go either way on that. Mm-hmm. It's what it is it's a rare use So it's one that would be used in a particular context, and probably you wouldn't use it every time you said weather, but once in a while. And so it would be, you know, it would be kind of stand out. And I think it would be more in speech rather than in print.
All right. Well, our guest this morning, Dennis Barron, and word-wise, he's very wise. He's a wise guy.
Wise guy.
Yeah.
A good fellow.
All right. He is that, too. Let's talk with someone else, local, I think, on our line four. Hello. Is a caller there on line number four?
Oh, yeah. I'm on line number four. Hi.
Yes, hi.
Let's see. I'm not sure this is a complaint, but let's see how it goes. I wonder when the word spelled N-U-C-L-E-A-R came to be pronounced...
Nuclear.
Right.
Probably pretty quickly. It's a dialectal variation, and you get nuclear. It's the same kind of phenomenon. People, you know, you get library instead of library, athlete instead of athlete. We do these little things with words all the time, and sometimes we judge people by those kinds of pronunciation irregularities. Well, they're not irregularities, they're just different from the way we either use the word ourselves or think it ought to be used, and so we make judgments. I guess the example I like to give on nuclear is Jimmy Carter. The president, who had a master's degree in what he called nuclear engineering. Right?
Did not also Dwight Eisenhower?
Could be.
Say, it was a little before my time.
But I tried not to listen to him very much because
he
was not a great communicator. Yeah.
That is that the press seems to be picking that up, too.
Mm. Yeah, well, the press, you know, anything for a story.
Well, they help form our language.
Yeah, they do. And the other example I would give for, you know, the influence of the press. I grew up in New York City, and I suppose it's because New Yorkers tend to not pronounce R's a lot of the time in certain kinds of situations. I remember, one of the things I remember about elementary school is the teacher drilling into us. I don't remember which grade it was, probably third grade. We had a particularly drilly kind of teacher. The second month of the year, February, you know, has two R's, so pronounce them. February. So I grew up being very self-conscious about the pronunciation of February. And we'd listen to the nightly news, and every night for 28 days and occasionally 29, Walter Cronkite would say, and that's the way it is tonight, February 17th, you know, whatever, 1962. Yeah, he said February. And boy, Walter, if he was not someone to look up to linguistically as well as, you know, morally, and, you know, he told you what the news was. So there you have it.
Well, we ought to say nuclear.
Our idols have lips of clay. What? No, that didn't work.
Well, I'm with the caller on this one. This is one of the ones that bothers
nuclear.
Me.
I don't like nuclear myself. I have to admit, I don't like nuclear.
Well, it just doesn't spell
I think
all
people
right
who
right
say that ought to be blown up.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you for the
or
call.
Maybe if you irradiated them, that would get them to pronounce it right.
I don't think so. And it does not seem to me that it's saying
vowels of mass destruction.
WMD? VMD.
VMD. Yeah, it's a great abbreviation. It ought to have a phrase that goes with it.
Vowels of mass destruction.
You got VMD.
Well, penicillin will take care of that.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Thank you very much. Let's go on.
You got drug-resistant VMD.
Champagne. Line number three. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Mine is a complaint, but it's also something of a question to Mr. Inge. Uh-oh. Do broadcasters get paid for back at retirement for the vowels they don't use?
No.
Our guest today.
Non-compensable vowels.
Yeah, I'm afraid not.
that one just drives me nuts. Chicago winners yesterday over Minnesota. Anyway, I'll just hang up and see if you have any other comments. Thanks.
Oh, I see. You mean just? I think he means dropping words, perhaps.
Ah, uh-huh. Well, we bank some of our vocabulary.
Mm.
Well, like the IRA, you know.
Like the Irish Republican Army?
No, the investment instrument. You know, I'm talking about sound money here. After a certain age, you can start withdrawing some of those words.
Uh-huh. Do they increase
in
value?
You keep your wide ties in the back of the closet because someday they'll be back in fashion.
Yeah, unfortunately, I do have a feel like that, yeah. Okay. The one thing I guess I would say about broadcasters in particular, I think that there has been a kind of an economy placed on how few words you can get across the idea. I don't know that that's really – there's a really good reason for that, but sometimes I think we have done that.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're dealing with – even with the luxury of not having to cut to commercials on public broadcasting, you do have a time limit, and you have to get, you know, whatever it is you're going to say within that time limit. And so being terse – and saying things succinctly is a fairly important thing for journalism in general. In print journalism, you have space limitations. Mm. And in broadcast journalism, you have time limitations. So I think there is a certain amount of training to, you know, get it out there and don't confuse me with words.
Well, there's the other thing that when it comes to sports, the normal rules of language don't apply.
Right, because sports is a question of filling time. Because nothing is really, here's my own personal entertainment bias, right? Nothing is really happening, right? I mean, I used to listen to baseball on the radio. Imagine what, you know, the job of a game broadcaster on the radio when you can't see what's going on. The listeners can't see what's going on, and presumably they're doing something else and listening to the radio as a kind of supplement to whatever it is they're doing, so you don't have to fill their consciousness completely. The listeners, but you do have to, you know, make this picture of what's going on,
and sometimes an there isn't
talent.
Much going on,
and sometimes there
in
isn't
a,
much
in a baseball
going on.
Game.
So they're a little slow, right? You know, so if you're at the game, you can, you know, go and get something to eat, and so on. If you're watching it on TV, you can do stuff, but so you got to fill that empty space, that dead air. Otherwise, you got dead air.
Well, our guest this morning is Dennis Barron. He's a professor of English at University of Illinois. Never dead air when he's here.
Not when I'm on. The lights keep blinking.
That's right. We talk about language. If you have grammar questions,
you
may ask those. And often when we do these programs, people do like to complain about misuse, and that's fine. Certainly, I'm sure you could just listen to my program.
If you just want to whine, I mean, you don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to be a formal complaint. We have the informal complaint, the whine. You know, the little grumble is okay, too, you know. The doctor is in.
Dr. Grammar.
Dr.
Sometimes
Grammar.
That's what he's known as.
Sometimes they call me that.
You do indeed have a question on grammar. Give us a call. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. If you are outside of the immediate direct dial area, you may use the toll-free line 800-222-9455.
Or you could just yell really, really loud.
Open up the window and yell very loud.
I'm not going to take this anymore.
Matt Toon is next caller, line one. Hello.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was doing something else while listening to the radio.
That's good.
That's what people do all the time.
We were sort of counting on that, frankly.
Right. Well, good McMorning to you. Just a couple of things. Speaking of our president and nuclear, I could have sworn yesterday in the press conference he twice mentioned messing out.
I heard that. I heard it. Yes, I'm not
punishment.
Making it up, right?
What?
He said it. He
what
said
did he say?
Metting out just
messing out.
Instead
punishment
of meeting out.
Yeah, commiserate. But I think he used the word commiserate.
Okay. Twice. Okay. I didn't hear that one. I was so excited about metting out. I haven't heard him make a mistake in a while. So, but that's probably because I haven't been listening.
No,
you know,
point,
maybe
man.
Throw those in there just to keep us on our toes.
He's getting ready for the campaign. I mean, you know, what's a Bush campaign without a lot of linguistic mistakes?
There's one usage I want to commend, and I want to spread it more. I heard it first when I was in Arkansas, and it's a southern usage of the might would, might should, might
oh,
would.
The double modal.
I love them.
It's called a double modal. You might could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I might could carry you home tonight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The complaint I have is refer back.
Okay, refer back, because that's sort of redundant.
Yeah.
Because refer means to carry back.
Look it up, yeah. Back or forward or wherever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, that's it.
All right, thank you for the call. That's we do sometimes have the tendency to double up on words like that, and I'm not sure either that's because you're trying to make a point or because you're not quite certain. You're not quite certain. You want to make sure people know what it is you're saying. You're not quite certain.
Yeah, it has, you know, language. It doesn't always work logically. Okay, sometimes we say more than the minimum that you need to say to communicate. So why is that? And I think one of the reasons is that we want to ensure that the communication is successful. There is built into every communication channel a certain amount of noise, if you want me to, you know, you excuse the technical kind of description. And one of the things language has built into it as a communication system is a set of noise-defeating mechanisms. So we need to overcome. Sometimes the noise is, you know, literal noise. A bus is going by, and the person you're talking to, their words are drowned out. And so, you know, they have one of the noise-defeating mechanisms is if we hear competing, you know, a plane or a bus or a car noise, we talk louder. Or we can repeat. That's another noise-defeating mechanism. Or emphasis is a noise-defeating mechanism, because what you're trying to do is make sure that the listener or the reader gets it, so that they don't have to come back and ask. You know, it's an attempt to obviate questioning, to make questioning unnecessary. So we do this. And, you know, sometimes we overdo it, and then people get annoyed by it. You know, you don't have to tell me, I get it, okay? Enough, stop.
All right.
And it wasn't that good to begin with, you know, so.
Well, we have other callers. Let's go to Champagne, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I need some ethical advice.
Oh, okay.
I'm a teacher, and not at the university, but one of my students said that you can get in trouble over at the university if you use the phrase rule of thumb.
Ah, okay. Go ahead and say what you're going to say.
I always used it. I always thought it was a nice little phrase, kind of like Baker's Dozen and that. But I found out from them that it meant that the rule of thumb was the size of a switch that you could use to beat your wife.
That's baloney. It's an urban legend that somehow grew up. Nobody knows quite where it grew up. It has no basis in fact whatsoever. It's an interesting story. It's a nice story, and it is used sometimes to enforce a kind of, you know, language prescription, saying, you know, don't you know, because you want to not use language that's going to insult people. But in fact, it comes from the simple fact that in the pre-ruler age, to measure carpenters or builders, you measured by body parts. You know, you measured by the length of your forearm, you measured by a finger, you measured by things like that. So the rule of thumb is simply a finger measurement. It's a rough measurement, as you know, before we had standardized inches and meters and things like that.
Is it true that an inch is Henry VIII's thumb between the nail and the knuckle, or the nail?
I've heard that. I really don't know.
And I've heard a foot. It was Henry
I don't think
VIII's
it
foot.
Is. You know, I mean, there may have been. You know, Henry VIII was kind of had a big ego, and so it could be that, you know, an inch was around long before Henry VIII and before his thumb. So he might have attempted to standardize it. I have no idea whether he did or not. But you know, foot, of course, is obvious. You know, the one that still has a body part name to it, and in fact, and measuring things off by paces, we still sometimes do that. If you want to get a rough idea how big a room is, you walk it, and things like that. So it's still very, very common for us to do this. You know, we don't have our laser level with us, and we just, you know, it looks about right.
Well, you've been a big relief. I really don't like to use language that offends people,
right,
but I really did like my little phrase, rule of thumb.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's perfectly okay, but you have to realize that some people are going to be carrying around the burden of that urban legend, and so you will meet people who say, oh, don't, you know, that's insulting, and then you have to give them the song and dance that,
well,
that I just gave, and how it's just really not.
I'll use you as the ultimate authority.
Okay, okay.
That's right. All
okay.
right.
Thank
you for the call. Let's go to...
As long as I have to pay the ultimate price.
We'll go to the next caller on a cell phone here on line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We have an issue in my family. I use the word llama, and my husband insists that it should be pronounced yama for the dictionary. I think common usage is appropriate, and I wanted to see what you thought about that.
Well, I can tell you what Ogden Nash said.
Okay, I love Ogden Nash.
The 1L llama, he's a priest. The 2L llama, he's a beast. And I will bet my silk pajamas there isn't any 3L llama. And then he has a little aside about the fire. That's called a 3L llama. Yeah, llama is what we do when we borrow words from other languages. And this is true in every language. When you borrow a word from another language into your own, you give it the phonology and typically the grammar of your own language.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we borrowed a French word, we would pronounce it with an English pronunciation. If we borrow a Spanish word, or I don't know if llama is originally Spanish or an Indian language, whatever it comes from, we anglicize it and pronounce it as we would. However, and there's always a however with language. There is the, you know, what you could call the pretension quotient, which is that people do like to show off when they use language from time to time about how much they know. And so they will try to give it the borrowed word, a foreign spin. And hence you get yama for llama. Which carries the double message, you know, I know it's a borrowed word, and I am going to pronounce it in the borrowed language because I'm smarter than everybody else. The problem with that is...
Not my husband.
No.
Nothing personal.
I do that, too. Okay? Maybe it's a guy thing, you know? I don't ask for directions. You know, you're asking for directions. I don't know. I wouldn't call up a radio show and ask for directions. When we give it that spin, it's usually not quite the way someone who actually speaks that language would say it. So that's what I mean by the, you know, the pretension quotient, because it's really not quite, you know, I don't know Spanish. That's not one of my languages. But, I, you know, certainly I hear that with French all the time. People will give it, you know, a certain pronunciation that you think is French. And then an actual French pronunciation is quite a bit different from that. So what we do is we flavorize it. We give it that kind of foreign flavor. I mean, you know, it's just like saying roast beef au juice, you know, with gravy.
So you just go on saying it the way that you want.
Say whatever you want. Yeah, say llama. And, you know, the families don't have to have the same pronunciation. You can have different health plans. You can have different pronunciations.
And so both
you can file separately.
So both would be correct.
Both would be correct, sure.
All right. Thank you much.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you.
But I go with Ogden Nash on that one. I would, you know.
So which are you
going
to
I'm going with the llama.
With llama. With the one L.
No, right. Two L's.
Oh, two L's.
One L is the priest. Two L's is the beast.
Oh, that's, all right. But one of those L's is silent.
Jess.
Well, all right. Well, let's go to Piatt County for our next caller. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Speaking of guy things, and I feel sure you've covered this, I am a teacher also, and I observe that my female students beyond high school age will still use like. Constantly, like, you know, and then like he said, And then, like I said, but they sometimes don't do it as frequently, I think, as people make fun of them for.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering if there is a gender-specific...
So you're saying that the male students don't do that?
I do not hear guys saying, well, like, and then I... You know, I don't hear that, and so I was wondering if there's a gender basis for that, and if there would be anything psychological. I guess off the top of my head, I would say insecurity or pop psychology, I suppose. And then my second question, and I'll hang up then, is I have read in older books the phrase, hoist by his own petard, and I love that phrase, and somehow I picture people on pirate ships being hoisted up, you know, the halyard or something. And I just wondered if you knew anything about that phrase.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
I'll hang up. Thank you so much.
Right, okay, well, let me answer the second question first because that's the quickie. Hoist by his own petard is Shakespearean, and petard is a bomb. And so what it means is, you know, you blow yourself up. This was before, you know.
It was a thing that was designed to blow holes in castle walls. And I think the idea was that it was something that you put down at the base of the wall in the foundation with the hope that not only would you blow a hole in the wall, but the wall would come down and you could get in.
Right. But, you know, sometimes these things detonate prematurely.
Oh, yeah.
And so...
Hoist.
So you get hoist. It hoists me here, Doctor. But the second question is a more interesting one, which is this notion of girl talk and gender differences in language. And it's often, you know, focused on the language of teen and preteen girls as having a kind of distinct flavor to it. When, in fact, you know, teen and preteen boys have their own kinds of ways of talking, too. But the issue of, you know, why is there a certain amount of linguistic insecurity? Sometimes this has been ascribed, you know, to women's speech. And I think it's been pretty much debunked by the research, but it's still around that there can be a certain amount in power differential situations where one group is either feels or is perceived to be less powerful than another group, that there can be more tentativeness in the language. And it can be, you know, boss versus employee, it can be teacher versus student, and it's often picked on in gender situations. And I think what the research shows is that it tends to be in situations, whether it's gendered or non-gendered, where there's a power differential between the speakers, that the speech can be a little more tentative, and so things like tag questions, things like up talk, raising your intonation at the end of a sentence, as you would with a question, only you're not really asking a question. Those are features, you know. I've seen, you know, studies that claim this is more common with teen and preteen girls, but I'm not sure of the exact explanation for why that is. And it may simply be a kind of group thing, you know, a group identity thing, that this is the way we talk.
Seems to me that
if you're one of us, you talk like this.
Like has become so pervasive, and I find myself using it to an egregious degree. Every time I do, I hear myself doing it, I'm unhappy, and I try to make a conscious effort not to, but it's one of those, one of those extraneous bits that end up being tossed into speech that you don't think about.
Right.
And do have some function.
They do have a function, and it's an important function. These fillers like and, you know, and 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 what they, or just, you know, a long ending of a word that you kind of stop talking, but you keep that sound going. And what it functions as is a placeholder. It's saying to the person, of course you don't see these in print, these are all spoken features. It's saying to the person or people that you're communicating with, I'm not done yet. Because, and again, I remember in elementary school being taught consciously to suppress sounds. It was usually and that teachers would single out. And so we were taught to suppress that consciously. And what happens then is that there's the silence that I just illustrated. And that gives the person you're talking to an opportunity of thinking, okay, they're done. It's my turn now. And so it's a placeholder. It says it's my turn's not over yet in the conversation. You know, don't jump in. Mm. And people will jump in anyway. I mean, and if you're from New York, no one pays attention to it anyway. And, you know, you just jump in whenever you feel like it.
We have other questions.
People in the Midwest are very uncomfortable with this.
That's because we're so polite. We have about 15 minutes left with Dennis Barron, professor of English at University of Illinois.
It's time to take the gloves off. No more polite.
That's right. No more politeness on this show, as if we've been polite in the past. We have several callers. The lines are full. Let's go next, and we'll talk with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You're making me laugh a lot.
That's the idea. Radio should entertain as it instructs.
Yes. I've been raised in the Midwest, and our family.
I'm sorry.
We jump all over each other. So it's not.
I feel your pain.
We talk over and yell, and
I've been lowered in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah. And so my purpose of the call is just to whine a bit about some situations that are totally out of my control but make me mutter and harumph as I stand around. And for example, in the grocery lane that says 20 or less. Things. But
I know what you're going to say.
That's not the one.
But you know what? Did I ever tell my anecdote on the air? I think I did once. But it was probably a long, long time ago. It was when there used to be, it wasn't even a Jewel, it was the Eisner's on Green Street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where there is the Osco drugstore now, Green and Neal. Right. It was a grocery store, it was an Eisner's grocery store. And I was in there once, and I saw that on the express lane, or whatever they call it, someone had obviously climbed up onto the belt and crossed off the 12 items or less, crossed off the less, and wrote in magic marker, fewer. And I think only in an academic community would somebody do that.
Well, that warms my little heart. But the thing that really gets me these days is,
but it didn't ever stop people from going on those lines with too many items.
They still do that, and the sign still says the same thing.
Yeah.
I guess it sort of balances out there.
Yeah.
But the one that's getting me these days, and it's in a major advertising line too, is the "have got." You know, you've got questions, we have answers.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they have to say "got," which really grates on my little.
Yeah, it's just an idiom. I mean, people do that. You got or they could leave out the "have." You got questions?
Got milk?
Yeah.
Got milk? You know, it said that "got." In that one, I mean,
that one belongs there. But I mean, the "have got" is just totally.
Why? Wrong. Why does it belong there? Why don't they just say "have milk"?
Have milk? Well, that's another question for us.
It's. Again, it's a kind of filler, because "have" is one of those words that is both what we call an auxiliary verb or a helping verb, and a verb, a main verb that has its own meaning. So sometimes you have to use it both as a helping verb and as a main verb, and so people don't like to say, you know.
Yes, but it's so much nicer.
To double the have.
It's much nicer to just say "have you." You know, whatever
right.
it is, instead of "have got." So anyway,
I think it's more American. You know, the Brits don't do that.
Okay, I'm going to hang up now.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
When you gotta go, you gotta go.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Advertising, again, is another one of those areas where rules don't apply.
Rules don't apply, and the idea is to catch your attention.
Hmm.
All right. The goal of language and advertising is to catch your attention, to make you remember the product, and so any means that they can do to do that, they will.
Yeah. And some people argue that then those will go on to pollute the language.
They will. They will go on to pollute the language or enrich it.
Hmm.
Because advertising slogans then become, you know, idioms and the subject of jokes. And, you know, there was the "where's the beef?" "I can't believe I ate the whole thing." You know, things like that. They form part of the "got milk" thing. You know, you hear that all the time in other kinds of of context. I don't like it. I don't like advertising. I know how to use a mute button. Fast forward.
All right. Let's talk with some more people here. Chicago. Caller in Chicago is the next person in line. Line number two.
Hello? Yeah, hi.
Uh-huh.
I can recall a couple of usages that are very common, probably universal, in the Green Point section of Brooklyn and the waterfront section of Jersey City. And
I was going to say, you're not from Chicago.
No, I'm not.
Originally.
How can you tell? Although I've been here about 50 years, but
yeah.
You don't lose whatever it is. I'm from New Jersey originally.
Yeah.
But these usages are not necessarily limited just to those sections, but they're, and these are toity, toit, and toid,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And green-pernt.
Green-pernt, yeah.
And since both of these sections are...
We said that in Queens, too.
Yeah, but I noticed it especially in those mm-hmm. coming out of those sections.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, since both of these sections used to be very heavily Irish mm-hmm. in population, I was wondering whether they were derivations or, of Celtic or Irish, whatever language you want to, whatever it's used to be used in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. I don't actually think so, but I don't know. I don't recall reading anything about the sort of the sources of the so-called Brooklyn accent, and of course it's more of a class related thing than
uh-huh.
almost than a geographic thing. Because if you go to if you know New York City, you see that it's very layered. That you can sort of tell by a New Yorker's speech whether they're sort of working class, middle class.
Well, those
how
were,
where they fit on the sort of
yeah, those
scale.
Used to be, working class and lower class.
Yeah, yeah. Areas. They tend to be those kinds of
yeah.
Things. Yeah, and I'm sorry, I can't really answer that question.
Uh-huh.
There are surely some Irish influences on urban speech, not just in New York, but in places like Chicago, too. But again, you have multi-ethnicities in the cities, in the areas where these dialects are forming. And, you know, there's the Italian block and the Polish block. And, you know, I'm talking about the early 1900s or, you know, pre-World War I. 1900s, and so it's so much a mixture that ascribing it just to say a Celtic or Gaelic influence, I think, is
yeah. On that business about like,
mm-hmm.
I've noticed that, and I've heard discussions on this, and or read discussions. On the same subject,
mm-hmm.
and usually those same people tend to end their declarative sentences in question marks.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. That is often that what we call uptalk, that ending of with a raised pitch, ending a sentence with a raised pitch. When it is not, I mean, there is a way of asking a question without doing the subject verb inversion. It's time to go already. Yeah, that is an actual question, but it's in a declarative sentence form. And transferring that raised intonation to sentences where there's no real question, it just sounds like a question. It sounds like I'm asking a question, but I'm not asking a question at all. And so why is that? I mean, there is you could say there's a certain amount of, is the speaker being tentative? Are they feeling, you know, like it's in a kind of appeasement behavior that they're trying to appease their listeners by not being very assertive in their speech or something like that? I don't know, because I think it's gone beyond that. I think it's just a thing that people are doing. And it's like a fashion. It's like, you know, it's like wide and narrow ties. You know, people do it for a while and they don't really, it's not having those kinds of deep psychological spins that it may have had in the beginning. It's just a thing to do.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. One could imagine that it's another one of those things in language that it's a way of, as you're speaking to the person, saying to them, do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Are you understanding what I'm saying? Without without coming right out and saying, are you understanding what I'm saying?
Right.
But it,
it is you know, possible to that the listener will respond by nodding or going you know, making a kind of indication of I'm with you.
As we're not doing
today. As we're not doing, right, you know.
Now. All right.
People are uncomfortable with silence, too. I mean, I notice that in the classroom. Sometimes I'll ask a question and there's no response. And sometimes, I do a lot of work training teachers as well. Teachers are uncomfortable if there's no response immediately, and they will either, especially beginning teachers, they'll answer the question themselves or they'll rephrase the question immediately. Sometimes you just need to let things sit for a while till somebody has something to say.
Mm. We will try and talk with one more caller at least. The next is in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Yes, hi there. I'd like to report a disconnected phoneme. And I wonder if you could offer some explanation.
We'll have to, you know, this call may be recorded for quality control. I have to warn you.
But time and again now, I'm hearing on sports commentators and coaches and things, the word football has become football.
Football.
They've dropped their T formation.
Oh, dear.
I can't think of any reason that you would just get rid of the T.
No, I can't either. I mean, I don't know why
football.
This is
it's like they got
football.
Kicked in the gut.
I mean, it's almost like you get a glottal stop there instead.
Yeah.
Football.
Yeah.
I mean, there's I don't know if there's some British influence, Irish influence there from soccer. Soccer. But I have no idea. I don't listen to the games, and so it's not something I've come across. And I have no explanation for it other than, wow, that's interesting.
It's starting to spread.
So it's starting to spread because,
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you know, we can test the line, and you know there are a variety of things that we can do. But you know, repairing language is not something that's easy to do, because while people want to be correct, they don't want to be corrected.
I like that very much. Did you make that up? Is that your phrase?
It is one of my. It's one of Barron's laws of.
Barron's laws of language.
Of language, yeah.
That's excellent. Well,
the other one is if you complain about something linguistically, that's a sign, A, that it's already too late to do anything about it because it's already ingrained in the language, and B, if you listen long enough, you probably do it yourself.
Words to live by.
Yes.
We'll have to finish there. My apologies to the callers we can't take. Another day, Dennis will come back. We're done.
I can go home?
Yes, sir.
I can stop talking like this.
We're finished with you. The show's over. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dennis Barron, professor of English here at the University of Illinois.